number three on this Friday night with Joseph Foster. All 3 hours tonight. We're going to hear some more fun things in this next hour, so sit back and relax and enjoy. This map, which everyone can't see yet, it's just an overhead illustrated map of the area of Middleton and the Navy Pier,
right?
And Middletown and the Navy Pier, yeah. Sandy Hook. That's not the same Sandy Hook as the school event,
no,
correct?
No,
not
that
at
was
all.
In Connecticut. This
yeah,
is,
long way
this
away.
This is Gateway National Park.
I right? didn't want people to get confused if they see this tomorrow. Now, the Sandy Hook Bay, I assume that where you had the Nike Hercules site, is that just like a little peninsula that sticks out there? Is that what that is? What is that? Or is that connected
actually,
to something else?
No, it's actually it's like a peninsula that goes all the way up into New York Harbor. 8 miles across, you're in Brooklyn, across the channel. And this is actually Gateway National Park. This is the New Jersey portion. We had another Nike site on the other part of Gateway National Park, which is in across in Brooklyn.
So does this peninsula, Joe, go all the way across to Brooklyn?
No. It ends, and then there's an 8 mile stretch of water,
I see.
And then you're in Brooklyn.
Okay.
But the oldest lighthouse in the country is the Sandy Hook Lighthouse.
Yeah.
Also, interestingly, the birth of the Coast Guard, you could attribute to the 10 life-saving stations that they built from Sandy Hook all the way down to Little Lake Harbor. If you like history, there's a fascinating historical story about that. But I could save that for another time, unless you want to hear it now. So.
No, let's do it. We've got time. And I want to find out what that Navy
okay.
pier is used for as well.
Okay, well, first, let me clear up the Navy.
Yeah, do the Navy Pier first.
Okay. The Navy Pier is about 2.5 miles long. It's the longest finger pier in the world. It was built by the U.S. Navy. The original pier was built during World War II, and it's joined to the storage facility 13.2 miles to the south, which is in Colts Neck, New Jersey, and that's Earl Naval Ammunition Depot. The Finger Pier is interesting because you have nuclear submarines that tie up there. You have aircraft carriers tie up there. And,
really?
So it's quite an interesting facility.
Is this pier?
Now, during the 90s.
Excuse me. Is this pier a typical wooden pilings pier, or is it a rock construction?
No. It's a concrete construction that goes out 2.5 miles.
What's it sitting on?
It takes a while to get out there. Good fishing pier, though. Pardon me?
What's it sitting on? What's the concrete sitting on? Rocks?
Well, there is bedrock. I'm not exactly sure of the construction of it, but it's solid construction. It's weathered all the storms that we've had and everything else.
Well, it's not wood pilings then. It must be situated on rock fill, some kind of fill material to cap it with concrete.
It might be pilings that go down to bedrock.
Wow.
You know, I'm not exactly sure of the not sure of the geology of that area.
Interesting. So the public is not invited out there. That's the point.
No. That's a secure area. So.
Oh, nuclear subs.
But the interesting thing is you have no problem. I mean, if you get too close to it, they have underwater divers. They have all types of sensor material, you know, devices and everything else.
Oh,
it's
really?
Definitely a classified area.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they have Navy SEALs that patrol it, and yeah. But back in the day, when they did have the interesting munitions, you knew when they were transporting them because there was like four crossroads on that Navy road. Okay, civilian roads that cross it, and what they would do, they would have squads of armed Marines that would stop at each of the crossroads, stop all the traffic until the train or the truck had passed, and then they go on to do it at the next one.
And Joe is talking about nuclear weapons here when he says interesting weapons and so forth.
Well, the only reason, because the Navy never has acknowledged that they store, which is common procedure.
Sure.
But like I said, you always knew when they were moving things like that. Nuclear weapons, because they'd always have the squads of armed Marines. You no longer see squads of armed Marines, so whatever is being moved is not of the same caliber, if you will.
Now, Middletown...
Now, interesting.
One other question. Middletown... Now, am I looking at Long Island? Is that what I'm looking at, a part of Long Island?
No. You would have to blow it way up. No, that's Sandy Hook. Sandy Hook is a spit of land. It's part of, actually, the kids, when it was Fort Hancock, the kids went to school in Middletown. They actually went to school in Middletown.
Okay.
So, I mean, it is part of Monmouth County. A lot of history there, though. I mean, the history is phenomenal. I was going to go into the history of the life-saving stations. There was a governor, the first Republican governor of the state of New Jersey, was a gentleman named William Newell. And before he became governor, he was walking on the ocean, on the beach, and... During winter storm, and that particular storm in the area that he was walking in, a ship piled up on the sandbar and was wrecked, and there were 300 people that drowned within a couple hundred yards of the beach. So it moved him so much that he decided something had to be done about that. He ran for Congress and was elected to Congress in the 1850s. And he met Lincoln. He and Lincoln became very good friends. And what happened was he got a $10,000 grant or $11,000 grant to build the first 10 life-saving stations, which one life-saving station number one was on Sandy Hook. And then going down to Little Lake Harbor, they had the 10 stations. They were so successful at saving lives that they proliferated for the rest of the country. Well, in 1915, there was a merger of the Life Saving Service, which he basically founded, the Revenue Cutter Service, which was the oldest seagoing force in the country, which was the basis of the Coast Guard, and then the Lighthouse Service. All three of those things were merged into the modern day Coast Guard. So you could say that he was the father of the modern day Coast Guard. But the interesting thing about him, he also was the first, like I said, Republican governor. There were Whigs before, but the Whigs screwed up very badly. And so you had people that formed the new party. The new party was the Republican Party. He got elected a one-term governor. He was hated by his own party, just like he was hated by the other party. So he didn't get to a second term.
Mm-hmm.
He was also a physician. And one of the things that one of the operations that he developed is still in use today. It's an eyelid surgery that he did. Now, after and he was friends with Abraham Lincoln, he is the physician that saved Tad Lincoln's life when he got very sick. Then the last thing about him, which is kind of interesting, he was also the first provisional governor of the state of Washington. And so he was the only person that was governor of two states.
How did he end up in Washington? That's a wild stretch.
The state of Washington?
Yeah.
Well, it became a province, I guess. It didn't become a state. So he was named, I guess, by, I think it might have been Grant, as the first provisional governor.
Got it. Interesting.
So, and
sent
he died
out there.
A pauper, which is kind of interesting. He is buried here in Monmouth County, in Allentown. So, there's a great book about him. It's called
Again, what is his name, please?
William Augustus Newell. N-E-W-E-L-L.
All right.
Yeah. And he's all but forgotten, but, I mean, the guy, to me, he exemplifies what a statesman is as opposed to a politician.
I agree. From what you've said.
Effective.
Yeah.
And he didn't get wealthy from being an elected official. I mean, he's everything that you would hope that an elected official would become.
Nice story.
So
nice story.
Yeah,
all right. So he's the father of what came to be lifeguard stations on the beaches.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the life-saving stations where they had the long boats.
I mean, those are the predecessors.
Yes, and, exactly. And they had they developed, different life-saving buoys and breaches buoys. And
so they did save lives. They actually did save lives.
Yes.
It worked. It
thousands,
was a success.
Thousands of them.
Wow.
Yeah. Matter of fact, 300 German immigrants that drowned, that, stimulated him to get the grant and build these things, are buried in, actually buried in West Long Branch in a common grave at the Methodist Cemetery.
They were going to Ellis Island? Is that what we're thinking here?
Probably, but the storm blew the schooner up on the up on the shoals, and they couldn't get off of it. It broke up, and they all drowned, which happened all the time. The New Jersey seacoast, even though it looks very benign, has a lot of shoal waters, and they had a lot of wrecks. Even to this day, there's wrecks that you can find out there.
So, was that does that appear?
Interesting story.
Does that appear on this map with the Navy Pier? Is that location on this map?
Well, if you go where the star for New York 56 is, the lighthouse is probably about a mile further north.
Okay.
And the life-saving station was on the beach side. So I could send you pictures of Sandy Hook. I mean, gives you the...
Yeah, why don't you? And I'll add it to this page, and then people will get an idea, a better idea of what that map is. Now, the drive-in theater. This is fun. The Hamptons brand new drive-in theater, opening July the 1st, Friday evening. What year was that?
Around 1954. So it was, I was very young. My sister was about 2 years old, and I was about five. So it was kind of an interesting thing, going to the theater. I even remember the movie that we saw. The movie that we saw was Mr. Roberts. Okay, and that had Jack Lemmon in it and Henry Fonda. And
how interesting.
It was a story about a ship, a World War II ship. That was my father's ship. That was the ship my father was on during World War II.
It was
the Virgo.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a J.G. on that ship that was on two ships, and he wrote the book, Mr. Roberts, and of course that was made into the movie.
That's where the screenplay came from, from the book. No, you can't.
Yes.
Now, this drive-in theater is interesting for a couple of reasons. This is the grand opening night, and you'll be able to see this tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I'll have the link up by tomorrow morning. It had a CinemaScope screen, a drive-in theater with a curved 110-foot-wide CinemaScope screen. So I get 1954, CinemaScope was the big deal then. But talk about a stunning movie screen in a drive-in setting, 110 feet curved. Wow. Now the opening, this is fun. The gala opening program, Friday and Saturday night, it says, I'm reading this, all CinemaScope show and all color. Soldier of Fortune. Yep. Starring Clark Gable and Susan Hayward. Plus, and they always had a double bill then, Strange Lady in Town with Greer Garson and Dana Andrews. And then on Sunday and Monday, also CinemaScope and color, Chief Crazy Horse with Victor Mature and Susan Ball, name we never heard of again, plus Moonfleet, starring George Sanders and Stuart Granger. How's that?
I do not remember that movie at all.
I don't
think I've ever seen that movie.
There's more. Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, the grand opening week, Strategic Air Command with James Stewart and June Allison.
Yep.
How's that? And then they had, and then High Society, starring Leo Gorcey and Hunts Hall. That was a short.
Mm-hmm.
The East Side Kids, I think. Anyway, Wow. In Strategic Air Command, you will get to see, if you ever see the movie, in color and on this screen. It's the most thorough documentation of B-36 bombers that you'll ever see in color.
Yep.
These enormous six-engined, and the engines were all pointing in the rear of the wing, not the front. They were pushing these enormous bombers.
Yep.
They were the predecessor to the B-52, the B-36.
Yep.
And you'll see it all in Strategic Air Command. What amazing. That was a knockout week. Wow.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was the gala opening. They made sure they did it upright. I didn't see, though. We went, it was later when the movies that we saw were a little later on. They weren't part of the gala week.
Isn't it? It says.
But
you know what else?
Was that there were no drive-ins around there.
Yeah. All right. Well, one more thing. At the bottom of this big ad, it says, drive out early, relax,
smoke,
talk, enjoy musical interludes. Is that funny? Drive out early, smoke, relax, and talk, and enjoy a musical interlude. Wow, fun stuff.
And people actually did that.
Yeah.
They actually did that. It was a social event. You know, I mean, it turned into one of those things, you just hop in your car and you go. But they had places to, you know, for the kids to play and everything. Of course, part of the fun was going up, you know, during the intermission and getting, you know,
snack
popcorn
bar
or whatever.
Yeah,
snack bar. Well, you know, right here in Monmouth County, we had an interesting one, too. Right next to the regional airport that we have, it was a fly-in drive-in. And they actually had it so you can have your plane come down.
Oh, come on.
And pull up to a stand. I swear to God.
And get a speaker.
I kid you not. You get a speaker. Yep.
Too funny. All right, here's one for you. I've restored a few classic cars over the years and lost a lot of money. But one of them was a 1952 Muntz Jet. M-U-N-T-Z, a Muntz Jet. And I did it right. And the guy that bought this car from me, You end up putting so much money in these restorations, you can't afford to keep them. So what happens? You get in the hole.
Right.
Anyway, this guy owns a big aircraft company in L.A. He makes parts for Boeing. Wing parts, all God knows what else. He owns this company at the Van Nuys Airport in Los Angeles. And he owns several big, huge hangars going back to the war years. And inside one of the hangars that he owns, he bought an entire drive-in movie theater, the screen, the snack bar, the projection building, all of the speaker stands, and he recreated it inside that aircraft hangar. And in all of the 130 spaces, he has his classic car collection.
Oh, what a great way to show them.
He doesn't show them. It's all private. It's not open to the public. He's an eccentric. And he said, I'm putting your car that I'm buying from you in the front row center. It was a very rare car. And this is true. I said, when is this open to the public? He said, it's not. I have two full-time men. All they do is tune the cars, run them, keep the batteries charged, wash them. This is inside a hangar. A whole drive-in movie theater.
And he never shows them or anything?
He has occasionally a private party, and he invites all of his client friends and friends, and they all pick a classic car they want to sit in, and they all get the speaker on the window, and he serves them, you know, whatever they want, hot dog, I don't know, and they show movies. But it's private only.
It must be nice to be able to do that.
I guess.
But anyway. He shows movies there.
Yeah, he does.
I mean, at least he's not wasting the movie theater.
No, but it's a rich man's toy, I guess. Anyway.
Yeah, well, it's a hobby. He can afford to do it, I guess. Oh, it's like Jay Leno. Ever see his collection of cars?
Yes. Yeah.
That's a pretty amazing collection as well.
Pretty amazing. Yeah. All right, so we're going back to look at one more thing here. Send me some pictures of Sandy Hook, and I'll add it We also have a picture that's a drawing, and it appears to be upside down. It is upside down. UFO sighting 1958. I'll turn it right. The UFO sighting 1958 is the right side up, but everything else, the other text is, it's flipped. It's backwards. That's what it is. The words don't read left to right. They read right to left. In other words, two depot located in Colt's Neck. To depot located in Colt's Neck. That writing is backwards. It goes from right to left. But look at what you sent Frank and see. I'm reading it. I had to read it backwards. It's all backwards. How that can be, I don't know.
I sent two things to Frank, two emails.
Yeah. All right. Well,
I'm not sure which one. Oh, Dorbrook article?
It's
Dorbrook article.
It's a map.
No.
And let me see if I can read it backwards again here. Object viewed from this location. And you have an arrow going to a location. But on the map itself, you have the box with the arrow saying UFO sighting 1958. That's correct. But everything else is backwards text. Don't know why.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
It's just been flipped.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, you're right. It has been. I guess I wonder how that happened.
Hackers.
I must have rushed
trying
on
to cause trouble again.
No.
Don't worry about it. Okay.
Because that's right. Because that curve, the curve road is the Navy road. It should have been on the other side.
There you go.
Okay.
All right.
I apologize. Sorry about
no
that.
No problem. Nobody can see it but me. And so
I'll
fix
get you the right one.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Joe and I'll be right back. Hold on. Okay, welcome back. Talking with Joe Foster. And it's, for some of you younger listeners, we did have in the 1950s surface-to-air missiles. The first was the Nike Ajax, then the Nike Hercules, which was faster and carried a nuclear bomb. The size, in some cases, of the bomb dropped on Nagasaki, Hiroshima. And that surface-to-air missile was designed to launch, to stop incoming Soviet communist bombers, bear bombers, at altitude, 50,000 feet, 60, whatever. They had a range of over 100,000 feet. But imagine something that could only travel 90 miles. They went like just a bat out of Hades up. They were super fast. And they would go up and, if they had ever been used, light off a nuke at 50,000, 60,000, 70,000 feet to try to blow up these bombers. Talk about overkill, but that was the mentality back then. Did you ever see a test launch of a Hercules or an Ajax?
I've seen images of them.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, there was only one test of a nuclear warhead, and that was done, at Bikini Atoll. One of the last of the open-air tests was a Nike warhead. And it was, you're right, I think it was probably around 50,000 feet. And it just looked like a ball of fire. That's all it looked like. They never, no missiles were ever fired from Fort Hancock, New York 56. Neither Ajax, which were there in 1956, to 1974 when they decommissioned the Nike Hercules missiles that were there. Mm-hmm. So they never had a launch. All the practice launches took place every year. The senior crew members had to go down to the McGregor Range down in White Sands, and they'd actually have to launch, prepare and launch and shoot down the target drone. Not with a nuclear warhead. They would use conventional warheads there.
Right.
So, no, but that's the common question we get. Did we ever launch one from there? Never did. Not even an accident. The only one that launched partially was the one that blew up a couple miles away, about 6 miles away at the New York 53 site.
So there was a launch.
That was an accidental launch.
How can, wait a minute. How can you have an accidental launch? Whoops.
Well, when the one missile blew up, it set off a chain reaction, and it actually fired the second stage before the first stage fired. So you had the interesting thing about Nike Ajax, you had a solid propellant booster that would fire for about 3.5 seconds. And by the time it finished firing, that missile was already supersonic. And then what would happen is gravity would pull the booster, which is heavy steel, it would pull it away. And there was a lanyard. The only thing that joined the first stage to the second stage was a lanyard. When the lanyard pulled, it opened up valves where three chemicals all combined, and you had a reaction in the motor, and that's what propelled the second stage to the termination and terminal point.
Highly volatile.
It was not real high tech.
Well, it sounds like what the Germans used in their Comet rocket fighter. They had two.
It's exact.
Go ahead.
Yes. The design of the Nike Ajax was based upon a German design that was never fielded. And everything else, so the fuels that they used, they were very consistent. They call it a devil's brew.
Yeah,
it's
sure.
Fuming red nitric oxide, I believe. Then you had the kerosene, or JP-8, I guess you would call it. And then there was one other oxidizer. And when they all combined, it caused the combustion. Very, very volatile. Very caustic, too. The men that had to fuel those second-stage rockets, they had to wear these heavy rubber suits. And if any of this stuff, if you inhaled it, you would die almost immediately.
Well, you can see exactly the same thing of the Messerschmitt 163 Comet being fueled and launched through films from World War II. The Germans had them. These were rocket fighters, and they would take off. They could only stay aloft for about 10 minutes, something like that, because the fuel only lasted for 5 minutes. But the damn things took off. And if they didn't explode on takeoff, they would go straight up at 600 miles an hour into these bomber formations, and they could shoot down, and they'd have to glide back down for a landing. I mean, it was, and the men that were depicted in the films fueling these things had these heavy rubber suits. So again, what you're seeing is World War II German science that morphed into the Nike Ajax and the Nike Hercules, same stuff, Operation Paperclip, that's where it came from. And the Germans, had another 6 months, would have had surface-to-air missiles. And they could have decimated the bomber formations, which were bombing Germany into rubble. If Hitler hadn't been so World War I in his understanding of aircraft, he would have given the chief of the German fighter forces, General Adolf Galland, the Messerschmitt 262 in 1941-42 as an air superiority fighter to shoot down the bombers. Yeah. But he wanted to turn it into a Schnell bomber to go over and drop bombs on London, etc., and fly back unmolested. And he wasted 2 years.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, you know, they were also not that far away from building a two-stage V2 type device that would be capable of bombing New York.
New York. Yep. Yep.
Yeah, there were a bunch of things. They weren't all that far away from an atomic bomb either. I think if they had six more months, it could have been a different outcome to that war.
Well, some suggest that they did test, they did perfect, they did have atomic bombs, but Hitler was afraid to use them because he thought we had them and would have annihilated Germany from end to end.
Right, yeah.
And that held him back. So we didn't have them. And in point of fact...
Do we have proof that
they had the atomic bomb? There's a lot of evidence that they did. There were eyewitnesses to tests, above-ground tests of nuclear weapons. You can find if you look online. Remember, we built two bombs to drop on the Japanese. When we captured that U-boat, when the final signal was given to give up, the U-boat surrendered to the American Navy, and on board that U-boat was a lot of processed plutonium for a bomb. And it is said that if you look at our first two bombs, they are so different in configuration and shape, it is said that the second bomb was made with German processed uranium.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's why they were so different.
That's scary.
Yeah, we know we got hundreds of pounds of processed uranium off that submarine, which also had at least one, if not two, Messerschmitt 262s on board, which the submarine was headed to Japan, but it was intercepted after the armistice or the cessation of hostilities was declared. And it was, I think it was May 9th when the final day of fighting was called off in Europe.
Wow.
Coming up tomorrow, I think.
And that's right, because they were sharing technology with the Japanese. Japanese
right.
were fairly well along in their nuclear experimentation.
Right. Well, this was fuel for their program. Another submarine, which had among the occupants two Japanese or three Japanese generals, that submarine was bombed and sunk. It's on the bottom somewhere, not far from its base. It was headed to Japan as well, with all these advanced weapons systems.
Well,
so.
all but fate. We lucked out on this on that deal.
It's arguable too. I'm not a big fan of communism.
No, absolutely not.
I don't think Uncle Joe was. He only killed about 100 million people. That's no exaggeration.
Yep.
So I don't know.
He knew enough about the human psyche to figure out how you can fool people.
Oh, that kind of advanced mind control was mm-hmm. sure. It goes all the way back to the 1920s.
And Antonio Gramsci in the 30s. And Saul Alinsky, he carried the water.
Well, who was the father of mass mind control? Here, Edward L. Bernays in the teens and 20s. So it was known. It was known.
Yeah. Well, some argue that Hitler and Stalin both learned their propaganda trade from Madison Avenue.
Well, they certainly didn't miss much, and it was watched very closely. They also learned mm-hmm. their eugenics from us. Eugenics was an American
sure.
program.
Margaret Sanger.
Thank you.
Margaret Sanger.
Thank you. I'm so tired of this Germany was evil from end to end and all that. No, it wasn't. History is not black and white like that. This just isn't. All right, let's get back to our...
But the problem is history is written by the winners.
Always. We don't really understand history because it's been so perverted and corrupted. So there you go. Like I say, it's all arguable. Okay, let's go back to our closer to home subject here. When you had your sighting in 1958, what was that like? Tell us about that.
Okay, it was a beautiful summer evening, sometime in July.
What was her name?
And it was after work. I'm sorry?
What was her name?
Her name.
Oh, you weren't out on a walk with your girlfriend? All right, never mind. Never mind.
No, I was only 10 years. I was 10 years old at the time. Okay. No, I was playing out in the front yard of my
just having
house.
Fun. All right. Yeah.
Yeah, we lived on the farm. My dad worked on that farm, and it was after hours, about 8 o'clock at night. So the sun is already set, but it was a beautiful evening. It was, you know, sun. It was still blue sky the whole bit, and my house is right on 537, facing towards the Navy Road, which is a couple hundred yards away. And we're sitting out there, and all of a sudden, there's this big silver sphere flying from the pier area heading towards the storage facility, probably about 500 feet off the ground.
Well, that's
and
low.
It had flashing red and and it had flashing red and white lights all around it.
In the daytime.
And it was going maybe, it was a daytime sighting, and it was a silver sphere. And my dad, actually, he jumped up and he ran into the house, grabbed the phone, and tried to call Fort Monmouth. But he couldn't get through the switchboard. He said the switchboard was jammed up. So, and it was never reported. That's the thing that really makes me crazy. But here's where it gets interesting. So we saw this. We watched it fly past. And, you know, I always remember it. And then it was, that was 58. 1970, there was the sighting also close to the Navy Road up there in Middletown with the landing. And then years later, I found out from the Nike site that I volunteer at, listening to the talk, that's the only time they ever armed a missile for flight, you know, fire it in anger. So I'm sitting there and said, is there a cause and effect? Now, we always were told that it was a single Tu-95 bear bomber, that they couldn't get the turn, and that two fighters pulled up alongside of it, and they finally convinced it to peel off. Right, and the story had it that that Tu-95 bear bomber lost its navigation system, didn't know where it was, and was happy to be turned by a fighter because now at least they knew where it was. But the thing was, you would not shoot down a single aircraft with a nuclear weapon. Even back in those days, I think that, you know, the whole thing would have been finished off by the two fighters that intercepted it. Right. So anyway, and I asked, I said, were you formally told that that was a Tu-95 bear bomber? He said, oh, no. He said, but that was the scuttlebutt that they had. And that was the story that's always been told at the, you know, during the tours. Well, I just sent you a copy of the report, the original report. So you might have it in your mailbox right now. It's a PDF. Of the newspaper article and the report that went along with it that was done by SITU, and that was the Society for the Investigation of the Unexplained, and that was Sanderson's outfit. A guy named Bob Worth is an engineer, worked for a defense contractor at the time. He was joined at the hip with Sanderson. Matter of fact, he published the journal, Pursuit, journal after Sanderson passed away. He and his wife produced it up until the 90s. But he was the investigator, boots on the ground investigator, that investigated the sighting. Now, the other part that's interesting about this is that the police chief from Middletown at the time was a no-nonsense police chief, and the name was Joe McCarthy. And he actually validated the people that sighted, that did the sighting. He said they're upstanding people. He knows them. He said they would not make things up. Well, there's also a photograph in the article shows the crop circle, small crop circle where the disc actually landed, or the craft actually landed.
Huh.
And the description of the craft was that it was basically oval shaped and had red and white flashing lights all around it. So whatever it was has been seen over the years in the vicinity of that Navy Road. So very similar to the sighting that I had Only thing, mine was all silver, and it was really a sphere. So,
how big do you think it
anyway,
was? You're a kid. How big?
I'm going to say 30 or 40 feet, maybe.
In diameter. That's
not
pretty good size. No, that's big enough for a crew. No problem.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Now there was other. Now here's the other interesting story. The Nike site blew up in May 22nd, 1958. May of 1958, at another Nike HX site located in Olney, Durwood, Maryland. It was Whiskey 93 for Washington Air Defense. Okay, the W indicated for Washington.
Uh-huh.
There, they had one crash right outside the integrated fire control compound.
Had what crashed?
A UFO crashed right outside the integrated fire control, which is where the radar operators and the battery control officer control the launch of a Nike missile, which is about a mile away.
Right.
The launcher area is about a mile away. What was going on there, and that was, again, May of 1958, they were discussing sightings of UFOs that were hovering over another Nike site, which was located in Gaithersburg, Maryland. So the radar operators were talking radar operator to radar operator, and then at some point in time, one of the objects actually crashed outside of the Olney Durwood site, and it dropped a piece of debris. Now, this was reported by a radar operator at the time, who was a radar operator at the time, a gentleman named Harlan Bentley. You can see the video. His video is online. It's part of the Disclosure Project. And he went on to work for NASA, and he was an electrical engineer, got his master's in electrical engineering and so on. So he seems like a very, very, competent and qualified witness to the event. But it all took place, the point I'm trying to make.
So a UFO crashes, mm-hmm, and then takes off. I don't understand.
It
sounds more like a landing and a takeoff.
Well, any landing you can walk away from, I guess, is a successful one. But all landings are also considered crashes. right now.
Yeah.
But apparently, what it was is it hit hard in the field, and the farmer that owned the field was on the other side of the fence, and the witness, Harlan Bentley, was on the inside of the compound fence.
Mm-hmm.
And they watched it together as it hit the ground and then take off again, but it dropped a piece of debris about the size, described it as the size of a washing machine. And what happened later on, an Air Force truck came along with a team that were in hazmat suits, and they,
mm-hmm,
had long poles.
Mm-hmm.
They jumped out of the truck, they picked up the debris with the poles and put it into the back of the truck. Then the truck took off, and a couple hours later, an Air Force officer came back and debriefed the entire IFC crew, which is whatever number of men that is, all the radar operators, battery control people, the technicians, and so on, debriefed them and said what they had seen was a crash of an experimental helicopter and that they weren't to say anything about it, and they left. And he said they all laughed because it was no helicopter. So, but that's the story. But again, what I find fascinating is that all this has taken place in that 1958 window, which is also, again, part of the International Geophysical Year, and all types of stuff was going on all over the place, with nuclear weapons testing.
Sure.
and so on.
Sure.
So, to me, it's a cause and effect, and that there is linkage there. But again, proving it, how do you prove it? You don't have a photograph. You don't have the debris in your hand. All you have is the word of the witness. If you Google Harlan Bentley, it's not that long a video, but it's very well done. It was done for the Disclosure Project. Harlan Bentley, Nike UFO.
Got it. Okay. Now, I want you to tell us very quickly about the U.S. Air Force pilot who overheard the shooting to death of an extraterrestrial at McGuire Air Force,
mm-hmm,
Base.
Okay, this story was related to me by Bruce Pearson, who you might know.
Yes,
Bruce
I do.
He's a fascinating, fascinating person, good guy.
Yeah, he's been on.
Guy,
yeah.
So, yep. Well, anyway, Bruce told me about 7 or 8 months ago, maybe about a year ago, that he came across this guy that they both collect antique cars. And the guy is a retired pilot. He's a retired commercial pilot. Mm-hmm. But when he was in the service, he flew for both the CIA as well as the Air Force. So I'm assuming that when he flew for the CIA, it might have been Air America or something like that.
Right.
Well, anyway, according to Bruce, what this guy told Bruce, he said, I had this event that took place in 1978, January of 1978. Well, that's the same month that George had his, the alien
George
that was
Filer.
Shot on the runway.
Yeah.
Right. So anyway, the story had it that the Air Force, the cargo plane that they were flying on, I don't know if he was a command pilot or he was deadheading it or what, they landed, and they were, when they pulled up to where they would deplane, air traffic controller, the Air Force air traffic controller, told them not to deplane, to stay on the plane until further notice. So they're sitting on the plane, and whatever time it was, and they tuned one of their radios to the frequency that is used by the MPs.
Right.
Now, the story had it that it was an Army MP from Fort Dix, which is just on the other side of the fence, was out on patrol on this, lonely back road on an unused runway. And apparently the creature was on the Fort Dix side. The guy told him to stop. It didn't stop. He shot it, and it jumped over the fence, and then it died on the runway, on this unused runway. And that's when they, everything hit the fan, and there were four MPs, or I think it was four MPs, or it might have been two MPs and two APs, the Air Force, Air Police. And according to George, then, of course, the rest of the story was the Air Force plane came in. The team jumped off, and they took over the investigation, commandeered the body, and so on. But the corroboration was fascinating. Now, the other thing, and I probably told you this, that about the same time, I was out of the service. I was working at Fort Monmouth as an athletic director at the field house. And I made friends with there were a bunch of local RAs.
We have about a minute left, so go ahead.
Okay. Well, I made friends with one of these agents, known him for a couple of years. And one night he comes in for his workout. He's walking up in the steps. It's in January. And he looks like he's seen a ghost. Now, the guy is very gregarious, always joking around, always friendly and everything. But this time he came in and it looked like he saw a ghost. And I said, John, what happened? I said, you look like you've seen a ghost. And he said they killed somebody on a military installation. Then he didn't say another word about it. And I never asked him. I knew what he did, and I knew if he wanted to tell me something, he would tell me. If not, I'm not going to push it. But he said they killed someone. He didn't say something on a military installation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the exact same time that George's event took place. So, again, is it linked? I think it is. Now you have two anecdotal stories that corroborate the original story, or at least indicate very strongly that the original story was accurate.
Right. Oh, well, there's another big piece of the puzzle. Very good. Joe, thank you for being here tonight. This has been great, getting some really nice email from people. They really appreciate you. So thank you.
Well, I really appreciate being on. It's fun talking to you, Jeff.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll do it again. You be well. Take care.
You too. Okay. Good night now.
Thanks, Joe. Joseph Foster. All right. That was good. Enjoy. Have a great weekend. Take care. And you know where to find us. Back soon.